Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who do you blame for the state of the world's finances? The global decline of stock markets and the seizure of credit markets has roots in the mortgage crisis, and conventional wisdom has it that subprime lenders made it happen. But that explanation may be dangerously oversimplified to the extent that it keeps us from recognizing other culprits, including those who pushed relentlessly to deregulate mortgage markets with an eye towards selling homes to people who couldn't afford them under the traditional rules. Stan Liebowitz is here to explain. He is director of the Center for the Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation at UT Dallas's School of Management. This month, he published a paper entitled Anatomy of a Train Wreck, Causes of the Mortgage Meltdown. Stan, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
We should start this by saying that fully a decade ago, you wrote a paper with a colleague that pretty much predicted this to the letter.
Well, I wish I could say we predicted it to the letter. We weren't quite that accurate. But we did predict that the change in underwriting standards that was taking place was going to lead to a large increase in defaults.
But back in 98, everybody said, what are you talking about? This is wonderful. All of a sudden, people who could not get into homes own their own homes, and it's working fine.
Right. The general consensus was this was terrific. We had home ownership increasing for the first time in 25 years, and both political parties were happy about it. So Clinton is actually the one who started the process. But when Bush took over, Bush was perfectly happy to keep saying, yes, it's the ownership society, and it's great to have more people owning homes. And nobody was looking at the underbelly, if you will, of this these relaxed underwriting standards, which were that they were likely to lead to a large increase in defaults. They were missing that information because we had the housing price bubble. And during price bubbles, when prices keep going up, it's hard to actually be thrown out of your house because you can't make the payments, because you could sell it at a profit, or you can refinance it and take out some cash. So you don't get to see the defaults that are due to the bad underwriting standards until the bubble basically comes to an end. That's what we saw in late 2006.
So now you have all these people who are essentially upside down in their homes. They owe more for them than they could get if they sold them tomorrow.
That's right. We have lots of those people, and it's because they didn't put anything into their house in the first place. Now, we have had quite a large drop in house prices. So even people who put a 5 or 10% down payment in, if they bought the house in the last year or two or three, may well be underwater. But many of the homes were being sold with virtually no down payment at all.
And traditionally, a down payment would have been, what, 20%?
The traditional standard down payment was 20%. If you didn't make the 20% payment, you had to buy something called mortgage insurance, which would raise the rate of your mortgage. You still would have to put something down, often 10%. But they started changing those rules in the early 90s, and then they kept modifying them so that you can still have a prime loan in recent years by taking out what was called a piggyback, where you borrow money for the down payment on one loan, use it to pay off the down payment, and then get the regular mortgage without the mortgage insurance on the regular loan. And the same bank would make both loans. So it was fully aware of what was happening. And it was just sort of getting around the old rule. And the old rule was there for a good reason. It was there to prevent large numbers of defaults when something happened in the economy that was going to shake up the housing market.
So you mentioned that you could still have a prime loan even with this piggyback mortgage. And, you know, so many people have said, okay, it was the subprime that took all of this down. And they look at a corporation like Countrywide, and it's sort of easy to stop the blame there. But that doesn't really tell the whole story.
Well, no, it misses the story in several different ways. First of all, it's not just subprimes that are defaulting. There is a higher percentage of subprimes that are defaulting than primes. But the actual total number of defaults or foreclosures is about the same for primes as subprimes because there are a lot more prime loans. But more importantly, when I was surprised when I looked at the numbers because I had read the general stories and I had an expectation, but it turned out the numbers were indicating that prime loans had as big a jump in foreclosures, actually a slightly bigger jump than subprimes, at exactly the same moment in time. So I had read about the contagion that subprimes had caused all these problems, and then it started seeping into the prime market. But when I looked at the data, that wasn't true at all. They both jumped at the same time, and primes had as big a jump as subprimes.
So let's go back again to the justification for relaxing standards in the first place on these mortgages. It was to give poor Americans, or lower income Americans, we should say, and minority Americans a better shot at owning a home. And there were all these studies, and you point this out in the paper, that said that they would compare mortgages granted to people based on ethnicity or racial group and find that, in fact, there were fewer mortgages written to people who were of color.
Well, there was a higher rejection rate for minorities than there was for whites. And it was quite a big difference. It was like 3-1. So you'd have a 10% rejection rate for white mortgage applicants and a 30% rejection rate for minority mortgage applicants. And that turned out, there was no data prior to 1991 on that. And there was a law that was actually several decades old called the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, HMDA. And they changed the data that they were collecting in 1989, and it first became available in 91, so that they suddenly took information on the racial characteristics of the applicants. So now they actually had numbers, and they came out with these numbers, and there was a tremendous amount of publicity. If you go back and look at old Washington Post or New York Times, it's in the early 90s, just story after story after story of looking at the data and saying, gee, these banks must be doing something bad. Look at these difference in rejection rates. The problem was that there are also different economic characteristics between whites and minorities. And you would expect minorities to have higher rejection rates because they tend to have credit histories that are not as good as whites. They tend to have lower wealth than whites. And so you'd have to want to control for those variables before you actually say that there's discrimination going on.
But that's not what happened.
Well, no. There was a study done by the Boston Fed. And they went and they got special data because the Fed can do things that normal academics can't. They can basically tell banks, you're going to provide us with this data. And so they went to the banks in the Boston area and they said, give us information on a lot of these credit variables that are important. And then we're going to do a carefully controlled study and see whether or not there's evidence for discrimination. And they did the study, and the way the study was actually performed was fine, the way they did it econometrically and the statistical analysis. The problem was, as I found out with my co-author, we had access to the data eventually, and we took a look, and it became apparent to us that the authors of the Boston Fed had never looked at the actual numbers that they were using in their calculations.
There were numerous errors that really belie the whole thing.
Right. You would look at the numbers and you would know immediately on some of them that there were errors. And it's hard to believe, even if they didn't look at the numbers, one of the things that economists normally do, and anyone who's doing statistical work, is the first thing is you print out a table of means and standard deviations and the high and the low for each variable. And if you do that, you find out that there are certain loans here that have like zero obligation ratios, which means you have a certain that's a ratio that has in the numerator how much do you have to pay for your mortgage, and in the denominator how much income do you have. Well, for it to be zero, it means you don't have to pay anything for your mortgage. So some of these loans were written down as they had zero payment. Well, what kind of loan could that be? That's obviously a mistake. There's no such thing as a loan where you borrow money and the repayment is zero. At least I would like some.
I'd like one.
Yeah. But even worse than that, we were able to run a comparison of different variables there to see if they were consistent with one another. So here's a simple thing. There was a variable for whether or not the loan was sold in the secondary market. And, of course, there was a variable for whether or not the loan was approved. Well, they have a data set of 3,000 observations approximately. And it turns out 41 observations were sold in the secondary market but were also rejected. And you can't sell a loan that hasn't been made. And so obviously one of those two variables was wrong. We were also able to take a look at the monthly payments, the length of the loan, and the size of the loan and see what the implicit interest rate was. And we found something like 70 loans with negative interest rates, not as good as the zero payment, but pretty good. They were almost paying you. We also found other instances where the interest rates were over 20%. Now, this is a time where interest rates were fairly high relative to now, and the normal interest rate was something like 8 or 9% on a mortgage. And so these observations also were indicative of problems. But if you looked at the numbers, you'd see, oh, this loan says it's 36 months long. Probably a zero missing. Probably really 360 because most of these loans are 360. They're 30-year mortgages. We know what the problem is. It's that zero. But we found hundreds of problems like that. We also found the data originally came from HMDA. And we went through 30,000 observations for the Boston area, and they took 3,000. And we matched the 3,000 to the 30,000 to see what happened. And for 450 loans approximately, we couldn't match it to the original HMDA data. So somebody was taking the numbers and transcribing them down, and a lot of this was done in the banks, and they were just putting it in wrong.
Carelessly.
Very careless. And the Boston Fed researchers either ignored it or they never looked at it. But it is hard to believe they never looked at those zero obligation ratios.
Stan Leibowitz is my guest. He is Ashbel Smith Professor of Economics and Director of the Center for the Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation at UT Dallas. His paper, which you can find online, is called Anatomy of a Train Wreck, Causes of the Mortgage Meltdown. So regardless of these mistakes, this Boston Fed study really became the catalyst for a lot of changes.
Right. The minute it came out, various heads of government agencies, and this is said this is the greatest study we've ever seen. There were some quotes because there was a big article in the Wall Street Journal. And I'm an economist. I read the Wall Street Journal. And I read it that day. And it was talking about this study, the first of its kind, because it was the first time they ever had data like this. And you have people saying, this is such a good study. We don't need any more. The head of the Boston Fed actually said, we don't need any more. The Office of the Comptroller of Currency said, this study is definitive. And I'm speaking to a colleague of mine, Ted Day, who's still a colleague of mine. And we're saying, gee, have you ever heard of a study that's so good that it's the first one and you don't need any more?
That raises your hackles as an academic.
Yes, yes. And we were laughing about that. This is ridiculous. That's not the way science works. So we said, we went and got a copy of the study, and then we asked for the data, but little expecting to find the types of problems that we wound up finding.
So, you know, no good American likes to hear that there are people being discriminated against. And banks also have they have to qualify for certain standards by ensuring that they're lending equally to people regardless of racial background and ethnic background. So they begin to make a series of changes in the way that they lend money.
Right. The Boston Fed, after their study, comes out with a manual about 6 months later. Says, so when we know that there's discrimination going on out there, and we're going to tell you how you can avoid discriminating. And some of the things that they're telling the banks are perfectly reasonable. But then they get into underwriting standards. And that is the dangerous part of this. Make any changes you want, but don't change those underwriting standards. But they decided that and they knew, in fact, is if banks were going to be non-discriminatory, completely non-discriminatory, it wasn't going to have much impact on rejection rates because even though they claimed that they had found discrimination, it still wasn't very much, and it couldn't possibly overcome this 3-to-1 ratio on rejection rates. So what they started to say is that you have to change and weaken your underwriting standards, and here's why. And they had a list of the reasons. And so, well, you don't really need a down payment because poor people have trouble coming up with a down payment. It's keeping them out of the housing market. And if they do come up with a down payment, they don't have to come up with it themselves. If some third-party charity, for example, wants to give them a down payment, that's perfectly acceptable. This is new. It hadn't been that way before.
And these charities often were set up by people who were building and selling these houses.
Absolutely.
Charities,
the person, the home buyer would go to look at a house, and the builder would say, if you don't have a down payment, that's okay. We'll take care of it. We'll basically give you the down payment. But it had to be a charity. So they would go through some front charity and provide the money. And then they would raise the price of the house because they weren't really in the charity business by an equivalent amount. And the appraisers would apparently go along. And those houses got sold.
And at the time, that was entirely legal and remains entirely legal?
As far as I know, that's still legal. What you found is that since the housing crisis began, the default crisis, they've toughened up standards quite a bit. And I don't know that you would be able to get homes now like that.
We are talking about the causes of the mortgage meltdown with Stan Leibowitz from the University of Texas at Dallas School of Management. We'll return in a moment, and you are welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stan Liebowitz. He is director of the Center for the Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation at UT Dallas's School of Management. The paper that he's just published is called Anatomy of a Train Wreck, Causes of the Mortgage Meltdown. You can join our conversation this afternoon online by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So we have all these changes that are euphemistically called mortgage innovations, which basically make it much easier for people with what would have been considered shaky credit or no credit or not a lot of money in the bank to qualify for houses. But as the mortgage innovations take over, it's not only people who can't get a prime loan who take advantage of this. You have all kinds of speculators pouring into the market.
That's right. When the increase in home ownership starts, which is 1995, after 25 years of essentially being flat, it starts going up at what is a very rapid pace for something that normally changes at a glacial pace. You wind up having prices of houses going up, which is simple supply and demand. Demand increases, price goes up. And so the housing price bubble starts in about 1997 or so, and it goes for 10 years. It goes until the second quarter of 2006. The price keeps going up and makes it more and more profitable to own homes. People start realizing, whether they're just by accident having to sell the house, that these things become profitable. They hear ads on the radio telling them that they can get loans, they can turn their house into cash. They start doing that, and prices keep going up year after year at a more and more rapid rate. I lived in California for a while when housing prices were going up. They always seem like they're going up there when they do go up at rapid rates. And I knew people I was a graduate student at the time, who were making virtually no money, who were buying houses somehow in order to make money. And that is what was starting to happen in large numbers, apparently, in the U.S. as well. The estimates are that 25% of the homes that were being purchased in 2005 and 2004 were for speculation. And that means you have a lot of people buying homes who really aren't going to be living in the homes. And so someone needs to fill those homes at some point. Actually, the increase in home ownership stopped in 2005. So the last year of the bubble, there's not new people entering the market anymore. That last year, the price appreciation was fully driven by the speculators. But it can't go on forever. Eventually, you can't find people to fill those houses, and the price stops going up. And that's what happened.
But a lot of these speculators thought, well, let's just take an adjustable rate mortgage. So for the short time that I own this house before I flip it for a fabulous profit, I'll pay a very low interest rate.
Right. One of the things I found when I looked at foreclosures, besides the fact that the primes were going up at the same rate as the subprimes, was that there was a big difference for both primes and subprimes between the adjustable and the fixed. There was a very small increase in foreclosures for the fixed rate loans. But the adjustable rate loans had this entirely, the increase was basically due to adjustables. And so the question is, what was going on with the adjustables that would have led to such an incredible increase in foreclosures? I mean, the charts, if you look at the charts on these things, they're just mind-boggling. They head along and all of a sudden they take a right turn and they go straight up. One explanation could have been, well, interest rates went up, and that's why you have more foreclosures. And there's some truth to that. Interest rates did go up. But they had gone up in the past, and there hadn't been that large an increase or much of an increase at all that you could see in foreclosures due to the interest rates. And the timing, in the second quarter of 2006, housing prices stopped going up. In the third quarter of 2006, foreclosures start jumping. So there's no interest rate change that occurs between the second and third quarter of 2006. So it appears that it's completely the home price. And the thing is that they haven't dropped hardly at all, and yet foreclosures are starting to skyrocket. So that's consistent with the story that says these 25% of homes that were being purchased for speculation, the people were happy to keep owning them and paying the mortgages as long as they thought they could make a profit. Once that profit opportunity turned sour, they headed for the exits. And there are states like California that are known as non-recourse states, which means you can mail your keys in through to the people who have your mortgage, and they have no recourse whatsoever, even if you have a ton of money, to try to get you to pay anything of that mortgage that you signed your name on. Now, most states are actually recourse states where you, in principle, could go after the homeowner who does something like that. But even there, that's more – it's on paper that's true, but they're not – they don't go after people. And they have been doing it, in part, I think, because the publicity would be bad. For all practical purposes, the whole country is practically non-recourse now. So a speculator who's perfectly fine financially can just walk away from this. And it was a great – I mean, if you really think about it and put yourself in that position, if you can get a $500,000 property, no money down, and it goes up 10% that year, you've made $50,000. If it doesn't go up 10%, you walk away. That's much better than the stock market. That's better than you can get even on a CD because you may not be guaranteed, but you can't lose, and there's a big potential gain there. So it's not surprising that that speculators were drawn in. I mean, they always are in bubbles. But this was one where they don't lose. They know they don't lose if they wind up being wrong.
Now, we haven't talked yet about the secondary mortgage market, which is the other huge part of this formula, because people would say, well, the bank still has money. The bank potentially was the one who would lose on this. They're lending money to these people, whether in fixed rate traditional mortgages or on these ARMs. But the banks really weren't that concerned because the banks essentially were doing the equivalent of flipping a house in 6 months. They were, or 6 hours in many cases, they were instantly selling that mortgage to a secondary party.
Well, that's correct. At first, the secondary market for these homes was entirely Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they were part of the they were brought into the coalition to increase home ownership, and so they agreed that they would pick up more mortgages and more of these mortgages with low quality financing standards. But then in the late 90s, some of the Bear Stearns was the first one. Some of the investment banks decided that they would try selling some of these mortgages into the private market. And it was an innovation in this case in finance. And they took the Boston Fed story. And so it's not just that they tried to change the lending standards. They tried to change what we knew about lending standards. They claimed that there was a new truth and what we had previously known about lending standards was no longer true and this new idea was, which was you didn't need large down payments, you didn't need credit histories and whatnot. So they went out with the sales pitch and they said, and look, the houses that have those mortgages are not defaulting in large numbers. And they were right. They weren't. The reason, of course, was because of the bubble. The bubble was hiding it. But they had the evidence. They had various government agencies who liked this result. And they found they could sell it. They could sell it to investors. And so then the private secondary market came in as well as Fannie Mae. And once that got going, banks found that they could get rid of loans that even Fannie Mae wouldn't take. And once that happened, banks didn't have to worry about whether that mortgage was going to go bad or not. Obviously, they didn't have to worry much because they could just pass it on to the investor who was taking the risk. The rating agencies, who really deserve a lot of blame here, bought the story. They had never rated mortgages because mortgages were not an investment that regular investors purchased. And so that unlike bonds and whatnot, they had no experience whatsoever with mortgages. Late 90s, mortgages start coming along as investments and they have to rate them. What they should have said, if they were honest, is, gee, we have no history. We don't know how to rate these things. We need to look at them for a while. And then they should have said, and we're having a housing bubble right now, so we don't know that we're getting a really solid picture because we know that the bubble is likely to distort things. So we'll give it a preliminary, maybe it's okay. But instead, and there was a lot of money riding on this for them, they said, well, they're holding up okay. We'll give them good ratings. And they did. And once the rating agencies said they're AAA for a lot of these mortgage-backed securities, the investors aren't going to do that much analysis. They trust the rating agencies. So they start buying this like crazy. And this is a gigantic market. What you have to remember is the mortgage, that housing market, is the biggest market for any one thing in the country. And so when you start having any sort of distortion in that market, it's big. And so you had this in all over the place. People were investing in these. And when they started to go bad in late 2006, what they had thought were AAA investments turned out to be much lower. And they wound up losing money. And it just sort of crept its way through the entire banking system and soured it so badly that a lot of firms were, because they were highly leveraged and whatnot, virtually bankrupt from their investments.
So you have this chain reaction because there is no solid foundation. These mortgages were sort of the bottom that everyone thought would absolutely be reliable. And as it turns out, there was nothing holding them up.
That's right. A lot of the mortgages were rated AAA, which means they should be absolutely reliable. And there are organizations that by law have to buy AAA rated securities. So your insurance company is allowed to buy investment securities, but they have to be AAA rated. Who says what's AAA? Well, the answer is the Securities and Exchange Commission says what's AAA. And so they say there are only – you have to be an approved rating agency for this AAA account. And there were three agencies that were approved, and they were the only ones. And so the government had a lot of control because they could have approved a lot more agencies, but they just picked these three. So if they wanted the agencies to say something was good, the agencies would know that, and there was a threat that they could take away their special provenance of providing these AAA – these ratings. So you did have the rating agencies giving them high ratings, and sort of the rest is history. And you know, so your insurance company would buy them, and they had to own AAAs. But once they got rated lower, which is what happened, 2007, that's why it was in the news, when the rating agencies started lowering the rating on the mortgage securities, it meant your insurance company can't hold them anymore. So they have to start get rid of them because they can't hold anything that's not AAA. So they start hitting the market, and no one knows how bad they are. And they keep hitting the market more and more. Nobody wants to buy. And that's where the market locks up. And that's the problem that they were trying to solve with the $700 billion bailout was, is there a positive price for these mortgages? Because no one's buying them. They're only selling them. And that was what they were hoping to fix.
Stan Liebowitz is my guest. You can read his paper, Anatomy of a Train Wreck, online at independent.org. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Brett in Dallas. Hello, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Great. Great show. It's a great topic I've been very interested in, and you just answered part of the question I had about bonds. But I am very curious as to how, once they toughen the standards, how home prices are going to react after that. And won't that exacerbate the problem because you have less people in the market?
Yes. If they go back to the old, more traditional lending standards, then a smaller share of the population will be able to afford houses at the original prices than was the case. And the prices would have to come down to a level where there would then be enough people at the new prices who can afford the mortgages with the stronger standards. So it is true that there's this problem facing whoever's trying to fix this particular problem. If they go to stricter standards, they will exacerbate the housing price decline. If they don't go to stricter standards, then they're asking for trouble somewhere down the road.
Let's speak next to Michael in Fort Worth. Hello, Michael.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, I'm just kind of curious, why has nobody just come out and stated the obvious? That no money down equals no pride or responsibility in ownership. I mean, everything that I've heard, everybody just kind of seems to be tap dancing around it. Why is nobody kind of taking responsibility for it and just saying, well, this is what happened, and, you know, can we let it self-regulate itself? Kind of just don't panic and self-level. Is that even doable?
Well, there are people these days who are critical of the idea of putting zero money down. There is still a fairly large part of the housing establishment that wants to keep zero down because there are people who will not be able to get a house without zero down. And that part of the housing establishment doesn't want those people to lose the ability to get a house. The other thing about it sounds like, if I understood your question correctly, you were talking about the financial problems that we're having now as a country. And it's not clear that saying that zero down means that you're not going to take care of the house, which may have some truth to it, that that's going to do much for the current financial crisis. So the attention right now is being paid to injecting money into banks, for example, which is the story today, or buying the bad securities, which was the story last week, because they're trying to free up a part of the market that's sort of gotten clogged down because banks are keeping their money in their mattresses out of fear that their people they're doing business with won't be around next week. And so that's why the main focus is not on zero down payment.
So by my calculations, we are now just under $1 trillion invested as a government into this bailout effort. I'm curious as to what you're looking at, Stan, because obviously many things were overvalued for a while. You had things in the markets that were overvalued. You had real estate that was overvalued. I'm wondering if now we have sort of undervalued things in our panic and trying to figure things out. And what indicators do you look at to figure out what things were really worth all along?
Well, there is a potential problem that economists worry about, which is that the market is coming down and there is an equilibrium price at any given level of loan standards. But when you have wildly fluctuating prices, you can overshoot it. And we would rather the price not go artificially low and then have to come back up, because then we'll have more foreclosures than we would otherwise need to have. It's difficult to know what that correct price is, and it's hard to make it happen. What economists look at is something like, what's the price of an apartment, which is the alternative to a house? And you shouldn't find apartment prices and housing prices, the implicit rental price of a house, being too far out of alignment. And for a long time, the housing prices, when you figured out if you would consider renting it, were much, much higher than the apartment prices. A simple thing, and I have this diagram in my papers, if you just look at the inflation-adjusted price of housing, it was fairly constant. It wasn't doing much. It just keeps up with the inflation rate. There's no reason it would do otherwise. It went way above that. It looks like it's getting fairly close. It looks like during 2009 it will reach, at the current rate of decline, it'll reach a point where it's now at the old level, and therefore housing prices don't have to keep falling. But if people hold back from buying because they think it's going to continue to fall, it could overshoot.
What kind of risks are we as American citizens taking if the government is putting this kind of money into something that has had so much trouble to begin with?
Well, it's not as if the government is necessarily using up $700 billion or $1 trillion. If it were to just pay people, like they could say, well, a house has gone down from $100,000 to $60,000, let's say. We're going to give $40,000 to the people in that house who are then going to pay their mortgages. If they did that, the government would be out $40,000. But if the government says we're going to invest $20 billion in Bank of America and we're going to take preferred stock, which is what they're now talking about doing, assuming Bank of America doesn't go under and assuming that it continues to do well, I hope it does well, I own stock in Bank of America, then the government can get all this money back. And it may not wind up costing very much. Depends what it does.
Stan Liebowitz is here. He is director of the Center for the Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation at the UT Dallas School of Management. We're talking about his paper, Anatomy of a Train Wreck, Causes of the Mortgage Meltdown. We'll be back in just a minute. You can call 1-800-933-5372 to join us.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stan Liebowitz. He has just published a paper called Anatomy of a Train Wreck, Causes of the Mortgage Meltdown. You can find a copy of that paper online at independent.org. If you want to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phone now and speak to Steve in Irving. Hello, Steve.
Hello. Hi. Yes, I find it odd, one, that the government would want to give money to the same entities that caused the problem in the first place. But my question actually is about traceability. I know in general terms, I'm hearing the politicians say, oh, we got to deal with the issue at hand. But who is dealing with traceability and getting down to the root cause analysis of who specifically, what entities caused this mess, so somebody can be held accountable to stop abuses in the future?
Okay, the last part of that, I don't think the government is trying very hard to discover who's accountable, in part because the government's accountable, and no one wants to take the blame. And that's going to be true, I mean, whether you're talking the Bush administration or the Clinton administration, both of them backed this idea of increasing home ownership, even though I'll give the majority of it to Clinton because he's the one who came up with it was under his administration that they came up with the idea in the first place.
Did they have benevolent intentions, do you think, or could they have foreseen some of this?
I don't think they foresaw it. I think it's the law of unintended consequences. They just thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to increase home ownership, and we could get rid of this possible discrimination in a minority pressure that we feel from our constituents at the same time. And why would there be a problem? We're just going to increase home ownership. I just don't think they thought about it very hard. And I know they really didn't want to know about any potential problems because, you know, I was out there with my co-author suggesting that there would be problems. And it would be like, you know, it was the equivalent of trying to say something to someone through a doorway and having it slammed in your face. The last thing these government agencies wanted to talk about was potential problems from bad loans. They just didn't want to believe it could be true.
Well, the party was raging on, and I guess until somebody had to drive home, nobody felt like there was an issue.
Well, that's right. Once the loans started performing reasonably well during the bubble, they'd say, see, we told you everything would be fine, and it's great, and it's terrific. And it was virtually a celebration. If you read the literature of people who are writing about home ownership during this period of time, it was like these were the halcyon days. This was the golden age. This was so great. And no one sort of thinking, what would happen if home prices stopped going up? What would happen if they started falling? There was no concern about that whatsoever. It was fairly remarkable.
In defense of financial institutions who got themselves caught up in all of this and really didn't do due diligence, I have to wonder what their investors would have said if they said, we're not going to participate in these kinds of loans. We're going to sit here and hold the line and be conservative.
That's right. I'm glad you brought that up. I forgot the first part of the question. The banks that the government's talking about bailing out now are not really big players in the mortgage market that was causing the meltdown. So it is true Bank of America bought out Countrywide for virtually nothing. Countrywide was a major player, big. It was the largest mortgage company in the country, and it gave its specialty with these types of mortgages. Nevertheless, you know, Bank of America was a small player, didn't do a lot of this historically. So they're getting money to help you and me and to keep the economy together, and I don't think that they're viewing it as a reward for the mortgages because they bought Countrywide, but they don't want to, they didn't expect to buy the problems that Countrywide caused. The other major players, Bear Stearns was the company that was probably most responsible for creating the secondary market in these loans. So they went under. I thought that was sort of fitting that they were the first ones to go. It's unfortunate that some of the others had to go with them. But the market has punished a lot of these. Most of the big mortgage companies have either gone bankrupt or have been bought out by someone else on the verge of bankruptcy. So the market has punished a lot of the players who were involved with this. So don't think that they're just getting off scot-free. They're not.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Mike in Dallas. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
Question. I need a little bit of clarity. You're talking to a layman, so you can break it down as much as you possibly have to. Exactly what is it that makes the paper worthless? Would not the defaulted properties go over to the persons that bought the paper? Why is it worthless? Aren't they worth something?
Oh, actually, that's an interesting question. They don't have to be worth zero, and I don't think that the expectation is that they're necessarily worth zero. There are two schools of thought on this. Some of these pieces of paper have homes in them, and I can't spend too much time on this, but they're actually virtual houses. The pieces of paper they have don't give you ownership of real addresses. They give you ownership over 10% of the homes in this group that default last or that default first, and you never know which homes those are going to be until things actually work out. And so if you own one of those pieces of paper that where the homes are going to default first, so all of them are now defaulted, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily worth zero. But the problem is they're worth a lot less than you thought they were because they're now in foreclosure. And price may have gone down 20%, or if you're in a state like California, it might have gone down 30% just because of the price decline. Having to go through foreclosure normally knocks another 10 or 20% off because housing prices go down when they're not properly taken care of and there are these costs of foreclosure. So you can imagine it being worth maybe 40 or 30 cents on the dollar. But now people are refusing to buy it because it might go down another 10% before it closes. And then it's worth, instead of 30 cents, it's worth 20 cents. So there's people holding back, and therefore there's no price whatsoever. And the point of the auctions that the Treasury was talking about having was to try to find out what the price is. And it's not clear the auctions were really going to be able to do that. But you're right. They're not likely to be zero. The houses on the other end of those mortgages should have a positive value, but possibly quite a bit less, only 20 or 30 cents on the dollar for some of them.
With the population growing, can we assume that a decade from now, somebody will at least be renting these properties?
Oh, if the price goes down, right, it'll be, you know, at a low enough price, you'll have enough people who can afford to buy houses, even with reasonable lending standards, that they'll get filled. The question, as I had said, was how much, how does price have to go? And it might be, remember I said we were almost down to the inflation-adjusted price from before. That before period had a number of houses that fit the population in a certain way at 64%, which was the percentage of homeowners with homes. Now we have a much larger number of homes, and it might be that the real price has to go lower than the old price, and that would mean we'd have to drop even further. No one knows that for sure.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gene in Dallas. Hi, Gene.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Great, good show.
Thanks.
I have an observation and a question. It seems to me that the real estate problem was fueled by the inordinately depressed interest rate. And that caused, when you started to get into the interest-only loans, this allowed people to get into the real estate market that maybe otherwise wouldn't qualify for those lower payments on those ARMs. And instead of them being able to get into the house, that lower interest rate artificially inflated the value of the real estate because people started to qualify. So instead of qualifying for a $100,000 or a $200,000 loan, whereas before you might have qualified for a $100,000 loan, you didn't get to buy a $200,000 house. They took a $100,000 house and appreciated it to $150,000 because of supply and demand. And now that everything's kind of readjusting, which you're addressing, comes to my question. Now that they're trying to reduce the interest rates even lower, why don't they look at putting some kind of a balloon on these kinds of mortgages 5 years down the road when the economy gets a chance to stabilize and real estate can find its footing?
Okay. Let's see if the part of the question I best understood was don't interest rates play a role in this? And the answer is yes. There was a period where the interest rates were quite low after 2001 where interest rates fell and they stayed low for several years. It's not – and it is true that that lowers the cost to homeowners and tends to raise the price of homes. But housing prices were going up even when interest rates were rising in 1999. And so it's not clear that the interest rate was having a really large impact. It was having some impact, but I don't think it was having the major impact. I mean, for one thing, you have to remember is if you have a home that you buy at an interest rate of 3% and you buy another one at an interest rate of 6%, it's not like you pay twice as much for the one with 6%. A lot of the payment you're making every month is the some version of principal. Even though it may say you're paying only interest at the beginning, the payments every month are a function of principal. And it won't be anywhere like 2-to-1 even if the interest rate goes down by half. So that it will have an impact, but the timing of when the foreclosures start doesn't fit. The interest rates had started up considerably before. There was no sudden change in interest rates, and yet there's this movement that's just remarkable where foreclosures start increasing. It's right after homes stop going up in price, and there doesn't appear to be any interest rate story you can tell that fits that data.
Well, and another element of deregulation and of the Boston Fed's recommendations was that a lot of people were suddenly allowed to borrow money that was greater than the standards that had always been set that would compare their monthly or annual income to what they'd have to pay for a house. In other words, 28% of take-home pay or 36%, I guess, of gross wages. And those numbers were slipped pretty far, weren't they?
Yeah. The Fed talked in its little manual about how a lot of poor people were used to spending at least 50% of their income on their apartments. And this is where they sort of got, you know, a little bit shady. They'd say, therefore, and it is true, if somebody was able to pay 50% of their income on their apartment, they could pay 50% of their income on a house mortgage, which is true. But then they make the statement that everyone who's poor can afford 50%. And that was the slip of logic that they go from if someone was able to pay 50%, fine, and now all of a sudden everyone can pay 50%. So they were recommending that this 28-36 number was just totally unnecessary, and there was very little linkage to that. And then, of course, once they said you don't have to provide any – and this was the private mortgage market – you don't have to provide any verification of your income at all. So there was a great story in the Wall Street Journal about a guy in California who was basically a water delivery man. It was like an Ozarka man or something like that. And they didn't tell you what his salary was, but it couldn't have been that high because they don't get paid that much. He owned two houses, each one $600,000. And he was able to qualify for them by inflating his income to whatever it took to be able to qualify. And he had done this several times before because, you know, he'd been in the business of he'd been speculating for a while. He made a bunch of money. But now, of course, he couldn't he'd rented one of the houses out, but he wasn't getting enough to pay for the monthly mortgage. So he was defaulting on them. And he was saying, this is really bad. My credit history is going to get dinged. And that's not fair. I've been a good customer of this bank. And, you know, he was angry over his situation when, in fact, he had taken advantage of it and made a whole lot of money. And no one was asking for that money back now. He should have been very happy with the end result.
What do we learn from this as a consumer society, assuming that we'll have greater regulations coming?
Well, one thing we should learn is that it's dangerous to try to socially engineer things and change conditions from what they were. So for 25 years, home ownership was about 64% with very small changes up and down. Now, why it's that, not some other number, who knows? But if the government comes along and says, well, let's just raise that number up to 70%, you should be cautious about doing that. This is a big industry. And if it turns out that there's a problem with raising it to 70%, it's going to have big repercussions. And you should think very, very hard about what the negative repercussions could be. And that wasn't done. And when things were going along and the bubble was going, like I said, it was pure joy and happiness. And there should be somebody taking a look at what the negative side of this might be. And I generally think it's not a good idea for the government to engage in something as big as this without really trying to envision what might happen if it goes bad.
Why is it, Stan, that we have in our culture such distrust and fear of regulation? When did that become something that we all decided was really bad for everybody?
Well, the economics profession, and I generally don't believe in a lot of regulation. I'm pretty much a free marketer. It turns out a lot of regulation that was done in the 50s and the 40s and the 30s and the 60s, because late 60s is when the deregulation got going, wound up benefiting the people who were being regulated. And so there was regulation on airplanes and traffic. And what they did was they said, you can charge any price you want, but you can't charge less than a certain amount. So they kept prices artificially high. And then when they deregulated, it was supposed to be good for the consumer, and they had real competition, which may have caused the industry to be financially not as secure, but it was competitive. And there were a lot of markets like that. So there was this move to deregulate in order to benefit consumers. That's a different type of regulation than what we tend to have over banks. We have generally lots of regulation on banks, and there were plenty of regulators there in the 90s. The problem wasn't a lack of regulation per se. The problem is that the regulators, instead of trying to say, let's make sure we keep things as safe as possible, decided their job was to make sure that we had as many people in houses as possible. That's what the people involved in home mortgage regulation got involved with. So they were
wrong
regulating the wrong way, yes. Mm-hmm. Whenever they talk about bringing regulation in, there's always the hope that the regulators will do a perfect job. They will do it in the interest of society, and that doesn't always work out that way.
You can read Anatomy of a Train Wreck, Causes of the Mortgage Meltdown online. It's by Stan Liebowitz. You can find it at independent.org. He is director of the Center for the Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation at UT Dallas's School of Management. Stan, it's been a great hour. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for being here. I had fun too.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.